much. Okay, so now, Michael?
Our dog got up at 3:30 this morning sick.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Fahey, and I'm the managing director for State and University Relations at the Wisconsin Alumni Association. And I'm happy to punt for my good friend Ben Miller at the University of Wisconsin University Relations, who sponsored this part of the program. And I'm glad to be here, glad to see so many great Badgers. I want to start by saying happy homecoming. This is, in fact, not the biggest event happening this week. UW Homecoming is going on. It's a great opportunity, if you're a friend or a Badger, to celebrate all the great things about the University of Wisconsin and our alumni. And you can join us at the parade on Friday night. And, of course, this Saturday, future Heisman Trophy winner Jonathan Taylor and the Badgers will take on Sparty. So we hope you will join us for any of those activities going forward. And again, it's so great to see so many people here, so many Badgers, and some of our faculty and friends. But I'm honored to introduce one of our most distinguished, well-liked, and well-respected faculty member. Probably doesn't need an introduction among this crowd because she's done great work and really some pioneering work about how to learn about what's going on and the opinions of the public. And we've been happy to be part of that effort. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Kathy Kramer. She's a former head of the UW-Madison's Badger Poll, and of course she's best known for her book, The Politics of Resentment, and really again has been a leader in some of the new techniques about listening to the public and understanding public opinion. So please join me in welcoming Kathy Kramer.
Good afternoon, everybody. It is such a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Jeff, for inviting me to be a part of this day and to be your closer. I have really enjoyed the panels and discussions today. I've learned a ton, and I realize I'm between you and reception, so I'm going to be super entertaining. Just kidding. We'll see. But I am here because of this book that I published called The Politics of Resentment. And I want to start by asking the question of why was that book so well received? And I think as I'm hearing many of the discussions today and reflecting on the wisdom that's being shared, a variety of things have come to mind. So what I'm going to do is give you a little sense of where I'm coming from, and I'm going to briefly describe what I talked about in that book because I don't expect that everyone has read it. And then I'll say a few things about what I think it means for the study of public opinion that book was so popular. And then I want to share with you some new, it's not really a public opinion strategy, but sort of a new project that I'm involved in with a group of people at MIT that will give us something to reflect on collectively. So this is where I'm coming from. I have always been fascinated with public opinion. I grew up in a household in Ozaukee County. Both my parents were public school teachers and leaned left. And Ozaukee County, as you probably know, is pretty Republican. And so I grew up in a role in which the people in my household were feeling one way politically and my best friends were feeling quite another way. And so the fascinating thing for me has always been, why do people feel what they do about politics? And how are they interpreting the world? And how is it that two people can see the very same piece of information and come away with very different interpretation of it? So I often in the field of public opinion, there's this question of how can people vote against their interests? Or how can people be so stupid, let's be honest, right? And I have always found that question very dissatisfying. Instead, I like to ask, not what are people getting wrong, but how are they getting it? How are they understanding the world in such a way that's leading them to the preferences that they have, whether we're talking about vote choices, policy opinions, or what have you? And so the thing that I've always focused on is, how are people making sense of the world? How are people making sense of politics? And as Michael Podhoser said in the last panel, that people are often making sense of politics with other people. a lot of the times we're trying to make sense of this world in our conversations on social media, maybe in interaction with other types of media. And over time, I have learned that the best way for me to study that thing of how people are making sense of the world is to listen to people talk, and to listen to them talk to people that are normally in their lives, people that they want to talk with. And that's the background for the Politics of Resentment book. So what I did, starting back in 2007, was to invite myself into conversations around the state with groups of people who normally hang out with one another. So I was inviting myself into gas stations and diners and places of worship and just walking in and saying, hi, I'm from the University of Wisconsin. I'm Kathy. I study public opinion. Do you mind if I join you? And they would look at me like I was a little nuts, which I guess I had to be, and they would invite me in. And I listened for years and years. I went to about several dozen groups in 27 communities across the state, and I wasn't looking for it, but what I heard in the smaller communities really surprised me, and it was this sense of not getting one's fair share. So people in our rural communities and our smaller towns were often talking about not getting their fair share of attention from Madison, from people in Milwaukee, but basically people who were pushing the levers that affected their lives. They weren't getting their fair share in their minds of resources, so a lot of times they're talking about taxpayer dollars and saying all the money goes to Madison and Milwaukee and we just don't see our tax dollars in return. And finally, they were talking about not getting their fair share of respect, saying things like, all you all down in Madison, you think we're uneducated and unsophisticated and you have no clue what our lives are like in a community like this. And they were resentful about it. And I called it resentment because for me, it was sometimes anger, but more often just this sort of simmering emotion that had been there for decades and in some respects probably building, that had many different layers to it. So it was resentment towards cities and city people, but elites, liberal elites, people of color, the Democratic Party sometimes. And so it was ripe for the taking by a political entrepreneur, right? It was this just a complex set of resentments toward cities in general that was very fertile ground for divisive messages, sort of messages that said, you're right to be so upset, and you know what? It's their fault. So when Scott Walker came along, I thought I was wrapping up my field work. I'd started in 2007. 2010 rolled around, a gubernatorial campaign, and lo and behold, this person gets elected, Scott Walker, and proposes Act 10. And if you were in Madison at the time, right, this appeared to be, given the thousands of people rallying at the Capitol, the most unpopular piece of legislation ever proposed, right? But if you drove 20 miles outside of town, the reaction was very different. People were saying, it is about time. It is about time that someone asked those public employees to pay in their fair share because I'm struggling to make ends meet. I can't pay for dental care for my family, and they're telling me I have to pay higher taxes so that they can have pensions and health care? How does that compute? And so for me, Scott Walker just exemplified the ability of people to hear that sentiment, to hear that resentment and respond to it and say to people, you're right to be so upset, and you know what, I'm gonna do something about it because you have been working hard and you do deserve more. And for him, a target of blame was public employees. So then I published my book in early 2016, and then Donald Trump got elected president, and people turned to me and said, what is going on in Wisconsin? Or what is going on in rural America? And so the attention that my book got was partly this question of specifically, what is it about rural America? What's going on in rural America? What's going on in Wisconsin? But I think that the attention that it did because it wasn't about preferences. It wasn't about these people support Scott Walker or these people don't support Scott Walker. Instead, it was a book about perspectives. which is one of the hardest things, I think, for standard public opinion polls to measure. It's that thing of what is the lens that people are using to think about this issue or to think about this candidate, or where are people coming from? What underpins why they're responding the way they are on this survey? And let's just be honest here. It's super expensive to do the work that I did, meaning I drove around the state. I took the time to drive around the state, stay in a Super 8, wake up at the crack of dawn, invite myself cold call into a group of strangers the first time I met these groups, and spend time listening to them. My questions were, tell me, what are the big concerns in your community? And then to sit there as long as they would have me and listen. Very few people have that luxury, right? Most of the time when people are doing political opinion polling, their client wants an answer tomorrow if possible, right? You don't have the time to drive around the state and sit down and listen to people. But it's valuable. There really is no substitute, I think, for listening. We try in a variety of ways, right? Open-ended questions on polls gets us part of the way. But there's this thing about sitting down with people face-to-face and listening to them talk to other people who are normally in their lives that gets you a glimpse on what they care about and how they care about it and how that matters for how they interpret political things that you can't easily substitute for. I learned from doing that project that the value of studying perspectives, but also the value of listening as a researcher, but also the value of listening in our democracy, because I cannot tell you how many times people said to me, you are the first person from Madison to drive out here and sit down with us. And the second time I would show up at these groups, they would say, you're back. And the third time I would show up at these groups a few years later, they'd say, you're serious about this. You actually want to know what we think. And I say, yes, I actually do. And so there are so many people, not just in rural Wisconsin, but across the United States, who feel not heard by our political leaders in general. And that the desire to be heard is something that I think as a democracy we need to focus on. And also this thing of having the opportunity to listen to people who are not like us, however we want to define that, in terms of partisanship, race, region, what have you. And so one of the happy circumstances of my book getting attention was that I was giving a talk at a political analytics conference at Harvard shortly after the 2016 election, in early 2017. And I spoke briefly about my research, and then a gentleman approached me afterwards and said, who are you and what have you been doing? Tell me more. And it turns out his name is Deb, his first name, his last name is Roy, and he's a computer scientist, computational linguistics, national language processing person at MIT. And he said to me, after several conversations, it sounds like you and I have this shared concern with the nature of our discussion in this democracy, meaning our lack of ability to listen in on one another, our inability to hear what people unlike us are thinking, the nature of our communication environment in which it's typically divisive, not nuanced, it doesn't surface the voices of the underheard. What can we do, he said, to scale up the listening that you did? He said, how could we do more listening like you did on a nationwide scale? And I said, well, I guess you'd have to hire a bunch of slightly nutty people who are willing to get up at the crack of dawn and invite themselves into coffee clutches. And he said, you know, he didn't laugh at that very much. And he said, no, really, my lab has the capabilities to build stuff. I think there's a way we can use technology to do more of the listening that you did. So I want to explain this thing to you that we've created. It's basically merges what I think of as the best of in-person small group conversation with technology. We call it a Local Voices Network, or the Local Voices Network, and Deb is my collaborator, and his lab at MIT is the Laboratory for Social Machines. And he spun off a nonprofit from that lab called Cortico. And so Cortico is this nonprofit that is basically the network operator for the Laboratory of Social Machines. And the purpose of the Local Voices Network is not, we're not selling this data, we will never sell this data. And so it's not to be a public opinion polling firm, but instead is to foster public conversation, public, and I'll explain that in a moment, that it helps us understand one another. So foster public conversation within particular geographic communities and within the media. So we have several things that we're trying to keep front and center as we design this Local Voices Network. One thing is that we want people to bring to the conversations, not their bullet points or sort of their opinions as much as their stories of why they feel the way they do about healthcare, meaning, so they're in, against Obamacare, and why is that? To hear the story, for example, of someone who says, yeah, I've never had health care before, but I resent having to pay for it now. Or I resent now having to have this bill that the federal government's mandating that I pay, and here's how it's affected my personal life. So we're trying to bring out the stories that people have about their various policy stances. And that's of the from the conclusion that it's when we can hear each other's stories that we best understand where each other are coming from, as opposed to you sit down in a group of people and they start giving you their bullet points about healthcare, what are the chances that you shut down, right? If it's not where you're coming from, you're not likely to hear what they have to say. So that's one thing that we focus on. Another is building these networks within particular geographic communities. So they're volunteer-driven. We have started chapters in Madison was our pilot because I'm here, but now we have chapters in Boston, across New York City, now in Birmingham, Alabama, and now in Wapaka and Appleton too. So the hope from the start was that we would figure things out here in Madison and then spread across the state so that people within the state would have the chance to listen in and understand one another. So those are some of the things that we're trying to keep front and center. And also say we're trying to have as transparent a process as possible, because you might have, as soon as I said merging humans and technology to do this democracy thing, you might have become skeptical right away, and many people are given our current environment, but we're trying to be transparent about all the decisions that we're making, how we're analyzing the data, and these conversations are public. So what happens is it's a public conversation network in the sense that it consists of small group conversations led by a facilitator who's a volunteer in the community, who's trained to use the technology, and then people are guided through a conversation that's very similar to the conversations I would have in gas stations, which is, who are you and what's a value that brought you here today? Basically, what are your values? And then what do you love about living here? What are your concerns about living here? What do you hope is different 5 years from now? What do you wish your public officials knew about your life? And then what's one thing you're going to be taking away from this conversation? The conversations are recorded, and then when they go back home, typically to the public library, recording devices, which I'll show you in a moment, all the data gets uploaded to the cloud. They're transcribed by a human. And then the engineers on the team have developed software that enables you to quickly search through, hear, see the conversation, and to search within a community, across communities. And another thing that happens is that during the conversation, the facilitator can play a highlight from another conversation within the conversation. The person can pause people and say, you all have been talking about affordable housing. Let's say we're in Madison having this conversation. You can say, well, I want you to imagine that there's other people in the room for us and listen for a moment to this conversation from Wapaka that took place last week, and then we can reflect on it together. So it's a way of bringing in conversations just in the middle of a conversation. People can start listening that way. But once you participate, then you have access to listening in to other conversations that have taken place in your state. But let me show you this thing that we call a digital hearth. It's designed to not look like a piece of technology. So it's lovely wood and fabric, but inside is an array of 8 microphones that can accurately identify who is saying what around the table. And so in the transcription, we're able to pretty accurately attribute which person said what. It's all controlled by a Raspberry Pi computer. And then there's also a speaker that enables you to play conversations from another conversation during the in-person conversation. And it's controlled by an iPhone, basically, an old version iPhone that the host or facilitator logs into. It's encased in a piece of wood as well, so that it doesn't feel like someone's iPhone on the table, because you've read the research, you've seen the studies and say how that interrupts conversations. We all do it anyway, but we thought we're gonna try and avoid that during these conversations. So the iPhone just controls the device, the digital hearth. We, here in Madison, I think I've mentioned before, we work closely with Madison Public Library, so just want to give a shout out to them. They circulate the hearth, so they're barcoded. These things, we have put them in drum kits, so a host can pick one up from a library, take it to wherever people want to have a conversation, whether it's a home, a library, a restaurant, although that's not as ideal for recording. And then, like I said, the host takes it back to the library, and that's how the data gets uploaded. And in most communities, we're working with the library as well. And they've been awesome for recruiting, helping us recruit participants into the conversations too. So far, we've had over 400 people participate. I think I'm a little bit behind on these counts, but over 115 conversations around the country, and over 1 million words, 1.1 million words, I think, recorded so far. But I want to briefly show you the online interface that if you're a participant that you get access to see the conversation. So this is just a video of me using the tool, but I'll try and get out of the, oh, I suppose that's not gonna work, sorry. So this is a map opens up showing you all the conversations, and then you can dive into anyone that the purple dots show where conversations have taken place. You can click on a purple dot and it'll take you to a conversation, or I think I may be frozen here. Here we go. You can scroll down through, oops, sorry, and that you see my punchline there. You can scroll through and see the list of conversations, and then they're showing you who hosted, where the conversation took place, and then often just a highlight to give you a taste of the conversation. You can scroll through each of those highlights, or you can then dive into the conversation itself, and then you can see the conversation. And by that I mean this ribbon is showing you basically who participated. Sorry, I know I'm right in the way here. Along the left side there, and then above the top are sort of keywords that are the result of an algorithm asking, basically comparing the conversation text to a broader corpus of English language, saying what's unique about this conversation here. And here now I'm just clicking into the full transcript, so you can scroll through the transcript, you can click on any part of it and hear the voices of the people themselves. So in a way you can, this is just giving you a glimpse of how you can explore the transcript. I should tell you though that we uploaded a new homepage just yesterday that the engineers have been working on that enables you to even more easily explore by topic. So say you're really interested in conversations about education, you can go right to conversations about education. So one part of this that's been really important for us that I mentioned earlier on is it's a tool for people within a community to hear within a community as well as across communities, but we're also working really closely with local media partners, because what we're hoping is that the conversations that take place then can become content for local media reporting, as well as reporters being able to find people in a community who have a concern about a topic that they can follow up with and do an interview. So we sort of function like a Craigslist where people, a reporter can't immediately get the identifying information of a participant, but can work with us to get access to that person. And here in Madison, the Cap Times has been an awesome early partner with us where they've helped us develop the tool so it's easier for journalists to use. They've written, I think, maybe 6 articles now based on content from the conversation. So in other parts of the country, we've been working with Wall Street Journal. In Alabama, there's a news organization called AL.com that's been a really important partner. In Birmingham, Wisconsin Public Radio has started to have conversations with us, as well as ISMIS and WISC. So it's all been pretty exciting and pretty positive. But the hope, and I showed my punchline before, is that at some point, there's one of these hearths in every public library in the country. And there's 17,000 of them. We have a long way to go. I think we're in maybe 50 libraries now. It's our hope that at some point, members of the public have the ability to better understand where each other are coming from. Polling has been invaluable in that respect, right? I mean, there is no substitute for scientific mass sample public opinion polling for knowing what the public thinks. And we're hoping that the Local Voices Network can be a supplement to that for helping us understand where people are coming from. And I want to just close by saying one thing that's really surprised me in the content so far. So I think I neglected to say we started in January, so it's less than a year old, and so we're still getting up and running. And most of my effort this year has been figuring out just the design, the technology, the infrastructure. But now I have, you know, the joy of actually diving into these conversations and listen to what people have been talking about. And one thing that has really stuck out to me is that when you ask the question of what are you concerned about and what do you love about your community, just how little Donald Trump comes up, for example. So it's very different than the conversation going on in our national media, for example. But as Celinda Lake was saying, I think she mentioned earlier today, that now what people are talking about in their everyday lives is likely not impeachment, right? They're talking about healthcare and jobs and education and housing. And I think a method like this enables you to hear that stuff, hear what bubbles up in people's lives, as well as listen to how, when impeachment comes up, how it comes up for people and how they connect it to the other things that they consider to be priorities in their day-to-day life. So thank you for your attention. I am sure you have a million questions for me about what this is all about, and I'm happy to answer as best I can. So thank you.
I'll just ask the first question. It sounds almost like a very informal focus group.
Yeah, I guess so. But for me, the distinction with focus groups is that typically these folks know one another and they're not paid. Paying people to participate is not a part of our design. And there's no organization or funder behind this who's trying to elicit opinions on a particular topic or candidate. Sometimes that comes up, but for the most part, we're asking people to talk about what it is that they want to talk about. They set the agenda.
So looking at the breakdown of the conversation, the thing that immediately popped to mind for me is there any back-end analysis that compares who talked for how long compared to the demographics of the room? And does that, one, because all of my work happens in a feminist space, so I know things have assumptions.
Yeah, yeah.
But beyond that, because I think if you're trying to draw conclusions or learn from this, I think it's an important piece of information. If it's, if one person or one group of people or someone is dominating the conversation much more than is representative of them in the room.
Yeah, great questions. So we do have a variety of metrics that are kind of just automatic now that are the nature of turn-taking, the length of statements, just how balanced the participation was across the participants. But you're bringing up one thing that's been one of the hardest puzzles for us, and that is attaching demographic information to the participants. Because by design, we don't ask people at the beginning, which box should you be put in? Because part of what we're trying to get at is people listening to one another without those boxes front and center. So we're exploring different ways of how do we, for me, for example, as a social scientist, I understand that thing of humans not wanting to be put into a box, of not wanting to be typecast as, oh, this is the 50-something black professional woman box, right? And enable people to instead just be fully who they are and not necessarily be of a certain category. But as a social scientist, I want to know the category, right? It's helpful for me to say, okay, how are women participating in this group and how are men participating in these groups? So what we're doing now is having people at the end of the conversation say, knowing that what you know now about how these conversations go and knowing that there's a possibility that part of your conversation is going to be imported into another conversation down the line, how should you be introduced? How do you want to be explained to other people? And that's not the same as checking here for gender, checking here for race, checking here for income, but it's one of the things we're trying to be able to attach some demographic information to what people are saying. So that's a very long way of saying, I don't have an answer to your question, you know, because I can tell you based on their voices who the women were in the room and who the men were, but I'm not really sure, for example, if all the women would identify as women and so forth. So, but the health of the conversation itself is something that we analyze with respect to each conversation, and then we've been adjusting there's a facilitation guide that comes along with it people use to guide people through the conversation, so we tweak it to try to get the conversations to be as robust as possible in terms of equal participation. Yeah, great question, thanks.
So I have, I have this other question. How do you synthesize, do you synthesize information or do you have to search by topic? Could you produce a report that was, usable by a campaign?
Well, I wouldn't. Because we, let me put it a different way.
You don't want it then to be so consumable, I guess, or so easily consumable.
No, okay. We don't want it to be a partisan tool. But anyone can participate in a conversation, and when they participate, they get access to the conversation. So.
Beware, somebody's
going to
try to use you, right?
Yeah. No, well, and I'll say that one of the reasons it's been a big part of our year is playing out different scenarios of how the data could be abused and manipulated. Not that partisans automatically manipulate, that's not what I mean to say, but you can imagine how there's just certain dangers.
Most people
Yeah, all right.
Okay,
this is so super interesting, and I'm just fascinated to learn more. What are they saying about healthcare?
Well, it depends, right? So it comes up all the time. It's probably so that's nice and reassuring. Right? I would say just about every conversation, there's been some mention of healthcare, and it's usually not stances on federal policy, but instead this is like, oh my gosh, this struggle, and I wish it were, and then it the way it rolls into other topics, so right, like I wish there were better public transportation so I could get to my appointments or get my mom to her, you know, that type of thing. It many, many shapes. It comes up all the time.
But yeah. Kaiser Family Foundation would be a safe interpreter.
Yes, and you know, I didn't answer your other question before, Jeff. Like, how can what do you, how can you make sense of the data, right?
Well, I can search by topic, yeah. But it's sort of yeah. like, you need somebody.
There's work to do, yes.
You need somebody to
yes.
order it for it.
Yes. Yes, and that's where that, those capabilities are ongoing as we get feedback from community members, journalists, public officials, just what we need to do to make it more more consumable. Yeah.
No, it's cool.
Thanks.
But I would hate to have the hearth at my house on some days. Anyway, so I want to thank Dr. Kramer, and I want to thank all of our sponsors, especially Outrider and Cap Times and University of Wisconsin-Madison, WMC, Capital Consultants, and Wisconsin Medical Society. It's been a fun day. I welcome feedback on this. We'll try to do more interesting things. And Dr. Kramer, I hope we can have you back sometime for a more intense conversation about the update on the project, okay?
Great, thanks so much. Thanks, everybody.
Awesome.